We are a little bit too loud, is what we are. We're in Habakkuk chapter 3. Here you go, Adam. We're in Habakkuk 3 is where we'll be taking our study from today, the last of our Habakkuk prayers. And then next week we'll be moving to Jeremiah 32, if anyone wants to have some idea of where we're going after this. So we've seen in the first chapter a couple of prayers of Habakkuk already, where he has lamented the injustice of the citizenship of Jerusalem, really, and asked when God is going to do something about the situation that they're in. And God says, "I will. I'm bringing Babylon." And that leads to Habakkuk's second complaint, which is something to the effect of, "Well, how is that right? That seems worse than the original situation." And we'll talk more about God's response to that in chapter 2, and then Habakkuk's final prayer in chapter 3 is what we'll be working our way through today. Let's begin with a prayer. Our good Father, we're thankful to know that you are a God of justice and mercy, and that we can count on you to do what is right, but also to look down in your love and compassion on us and do what is not only right, but what is best for us and far greater than we ever deserve. And so help us, whatever the situation around us may be, to keep our trust in you and our confidence in you and to seek to follow you in all that we do. In your Son we pray. Amen. So, like I said, the first chapter is this back and forth between Habakkuk and God, with Habakkuk's laments and God's response in the middle. And then chapter 2 is the lengthiest of the responses of God, which is that something to the effect of, well, they're going to get theirs too. It's not just that I'm going to judge Jerusalem with the Babylonians, but I'm also going to judge the Babylonians. I am not going to change my plan. That's where, you remember Habakkuk, at the end of chapter 1, again, asks how can this be right? Is God going to allow this to continue forever? Is he going to let the Babylonians keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever? And ends by saying, "I'm going to take my stand at the watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint." And so I'm going to wait and see what God says about this. And what God says is, "I'm not changing anything. I'm going to do exactly what I said I'm going to do. But what I didn't tell you the first time is I'm also going to judge them." So it's not that they're going to keep doing this forever. It's not that they're going to be allowed to just, you know, run roughshod over the whole world and do that indefinitely. They will be judged as well. In fact, he says in chapter 2 and verse 2, you know, "Write this down. Write the vision, make it plain on the tablet so that he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay." This is going to happen. But again, then they will also be judged. And there are these five woes that are pronounced on Babylon in verses 6 through 20 of chapter 2, and since this isn't a class really on Habakkuk, we won't go through all of that. But it speaks of their own wickedness that God is going to judge them for, their extortion and unjust gain and violence and drunkenness and other shameful behavior and idolatry. And there in verses 18 and 19, you have one of those statements about the absurdity of idolatry. It's kind of an abbreviated version of the same sort of thing that you see in more detail in Isaiah. "What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it, a metal image, a teacher of lies, for its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols? Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, 'Awake,' to a silent stone, 'Arise.' Can this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there's no breath in it at all. But the Lord is in his holy temple, and let all the earth keep silence before him." And so in contrast to these lifeless, powerless idols the Babylonians have built, God sits in his temple. And ultimately, the Babylonians are going to be humiliated and shamed in their judgment. But in verse 14, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And so Babylon is going to be judged. God is going to be victorious. God's people will ultimately be redeemed at some point. And that gets a little bit beyond even what Habakkuk is talking about. But there's maybe hints of that as well. And so that's then what leads to chapter 3. So there is injustice. Don't worry, I'll deal with the injustice. The Babylonians are coming. Well, that can't be right. You're going to let them do this forever. No, I'm not. I'll deal with them too, but they're still coming. It's going to be bad, basically, is where it still remains. So that leads then to this prayer in chapter 3. And we've talked before about how some of these prayers take the form of a psalm. And this one, more so than any other, takes the form of a psalm. Notice verse 1, a prayer of Habakkuk, the prophet according to the Shigayonoth. That's language that's straight out of the book of Psalms. We don't know what that word means exactly. It is apparently some musical sort of terminology, but it's not used enough to have any kind of context of what it means, except that it always shows up in the Psalms or in something that is a psalm apart from the book of Psalms. What we have here, this word is just a transliteration. It's our letters, switched out with the Hebrew letters, but that's how the Hebrew word would be pronounced as well. But then at the very end of verse 19, to the choir master with stringed instruments. Again, sounds just like it comes right out of the book of Psalms. So this is more of a psalm of thanksgiving than a psalm of lament, but it carries features of a few different kinds of psalms. The kind that it's most similar to are psalms of thanksgiving. Psalms of thanksgiving and psalms of lament, they're kind of related to each other in that they both address a crisis in the life of the psalmist. In the lament, they're in the midst of the psalmist, hoping that deliverance comes soon. In the psalm of thanksgiving, they're past that crisis. Deliverance has been experienced, and they're looking back on it from the perspective of having been delivered. If you want to kind of put it on a timeline, so to speak, where there's a crisis, you could say the Psalms of trust are before it, the Psalms of lament are in the midst of it, and the Psalms of thanksgiving are after it. Now, that doesn't mean that you can find any group of three Psalms that are talking specifically about the same crisis, but more or less, that's kind of how different psalms are related to crises in the life of psalmists. And so, even though this is before the crisis comes, Habakkuk speaks more like a psalm of thanksgiving. There is some psalm of trust kind of language here as well, but we don't need to get into all of that. We want to actually talk about what the psalm says. So, I'll take a minute and read this. This is one of the longer prayers that we have, but I think it's worth reading. So, Habakkuk 3. O Lord, I have heard of the report of you, and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from his hand, and there he veiled his power. Before him went pestilence, and plague followed at his heels. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the mountains, or the nations. The eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers, or your indignation against the sea when you rode on your horses on your chariot of salvation? You stripped the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. The sun and moon stood in their place. at the light of your arrows as they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear. You marched through the earth in fury. You threshed the nations in anger. You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. You pierced with his own arrows the heads of his warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. You trampled the sea with your horses and the surging of mighty waters. I hear, and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the food, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. All right, so this prayer is, you can kind of divide it up into three basic parts. The first verse is kind of an introduction to it, the acknowledgement of the reality of the situation that they're in. I've heard the report of you, and your work do I fear. I'm acknowledging that what you have said is going to happen is in fact going to happen, and it terrifies me. We'll see that again later on. And then at the end of verse 2, the very last phrase of verse 2, I think is maybe something of a summation of this entire prayer, in wrath remember mercy. He says to God, not that he has a choice, but I accept your judgment. What you have said is going to happen, and I have decided that I'm going to be perfectly fine living with whatever you bring. But my plea is, in that wrath that is coming, remember mercy as well. And so that's where this prayer begins. And it will end in a similar sort of way in verses 16 through 19, although it's much more spelled out here at the end. I hear and my body trembles, my lips quiver at the sound, rottenness enters into my bones, my legs tremble beneath me. There's all that fear again, right? Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. And so you have said that you will bring judgment on them too, and I will wait for that. As terrified as I am of what is coming our way, I will trust that you will do what you have said you will do. And then in verses 17 and 18, it really gets down into some of the nitty-gritty of what they're going to face. So the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines. The produce of the olive fail. The fields yield no food. The flock be cut off from the fold, and there's no herd in the stalls. I mean, stop and think about this for a second. There's no fig trees, pretty big deal, right? There's no figs on the fig trees. There's no fruit on any of the vines. There's no produce from the olive trees. The fields yield no food, and there's no flocks and no herds. What's left as far as eating goes? If all of the plants that you eat from and all the animals that you eat from, none of them are producing anything, what's left? Well, not much, right? And in fact, that's what happens a whole lot in siege warfare in the ancient world, is your food supply is cut off. And he says, although all of this is gone, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I'll take joy in the God of my salvation. What Habakkuk says is, even though I'm going to starve, I'm going to trust in God. That's really what it boils down to there. And that's a statement of faith that is pretty remarkable. He is much more aware of what this kind of warfare would look like than we are. It is about as ugly and awful as you can possibly imagine. You get glimpses of it in a few places in the Bible, or if you read historical reports, I'm sure you've heard of how bad it can be. I mean, all the way down to cannibalism. And Habakkuk looks at this situation and says, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I'll take joy in the God of my salvation, because God is my strength. And it's just an incredible statement of faith. It's, you know, what does it mean that the just will live by faith? Well, here's at least one picture of what that might look like here at the end of this. And so the beginning and the end of this prayer is the acknowledgement of the reality of what's coming and the statement of trust in God in the midst of it. And then the rest of this prayer, the bulk of the middle of it, is in verses 3 through 16, then it's statements about basically God the warrior who goes to war on behalf of his people. This is one of those images in the Old Testament, and it comes into the New Testament as well, but it's more prevalent in the Old Testament, of God as a warrior who comes in his awesome power and conquers everyone in his path. And it's an image that I know I've talked about it a fair amount, and so it's, I don't think there's anything new to people here, but in a lot of places we're familiar with, you know, God the King, God the Shepherd, God the Father, God the Architect, but God the Warrior is not an image that a lot of people aren't as familiar with, and yet it's all over the Old Testament. And that's the imagery here. And there's a lot of Exodus imagery in this as well, which is Habakkuk's way of looking at the past and saying what God has done for his people in the past is why we can trust in him in the present. God is a God who interacts with humankind in history. And so we can trust in him now because we've seen what he has done in the past. Even though we don't experience him right now necessarily, we know what he has done, and so we can continue to trust in him in the midst of these things. And so you see the power and the splendor of God as this is all Day of the Lord kind of imagery as well, where God is intervening in time and space and bringing judgment. It impacts the earth when God does this. And so notice in verse 6, for example, he stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the nations. The eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. Was your wrath against the rivers, verse 8, O Lord, your indignation against the rivers, or your indignation against the sea? It impacts the world when God acts. The earth splits, the mountains writhe, the sun and the moon stop in their tracks. The nations feel the effects of all of this. And then notice also in verse 13, and this is a really interesting verse to show up in the middle of this prayer and in the larger context of this entire book as well. You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. God is going out as this warrior for the salvation of his people, for the salvation of his anointed one. So you go all the way back to the beginning of Habakkuk, when Habakkuk is saying, God, aren't you going to do something? And then he says after that, I'm not sure I like what you said you're going to do. Well, you come back around here in chapter 3, and Habakkuk is realizing that what God is doing is, in fact, for the good of his people. He's not ignoring wrongdoing. He's not going to allow his people to go unpunished, or the people who punish his people to go unpunished as well. What God is doing is out of covenant loyalty. It is ultimately for their best interest. And this psalm, this prayer in Habakkuk 3 is really all about this coupling of God's gracious care and his divine judgment. God's people will be saved. He is going out for the salvation of his people, for the salvation of his anointed one, which itself is a messianic title, whether this is a, you know, messianic prophecy in some specific sense is a separate question. But the anointed one, the Davidic line, has to be preserved in order for there to be the anointed one in that greater sense as well. And so, again, in answer to Habakkuk's complaints at the beginning, in answer to the concern over God's ultimate response in the Babylonians, God's people will be saved, is the upshot of this. But not before God comes in judgment. And so God will come in judgment against Jerusalem, and then God will come in judgment against Babylon. And it's the same warrior God who will do both of these things. What God wants to do is be a warrior for His people. But sometimes, first, God has to be a warrior against His people. And that's what's happening here at the beginning, is God leads the Babylonian army against Jerusalem. And then He will lead the Persian army against Babylon. And then He will lead the Greeks. And on it goes. But God is the one who raises kings and knocks them back down. God is the warrior who accomplishes His purposes to bring judgment. And in the midst of that judgment, to show that mercy as it is needed as well. All right, so that's kind of a very, very big picture overview of this. As always, we're not getting in a lot of details, and probably less so this time than even some other times in terms of some of the specifics. I don't know if you noticed as I read through that, if you're reading along in a different translation, you may have had drastically different lines at certain points. Maybe not drastically, maybe only minorly, but there are a lot of the phrases in this that are just very difficult to translate, and different translators are guessing in different directions based on certain things. So there's some of this that if you say, well, my translation said this and yours said that, that doesn't even seem to be the same thing, the answer probably is that's because nobody knows exactly what that means. You still have a pretty good understanding of the big picture of the prayer, though. But before we move along to drawing personal applications and lessons and such from this prayer, questions or comments about any of the details of it that I flew by at 90 miles an hour? Yeah, Andrew?
I thought it was noteworthy that how far what he's written has come from what he first wrote in this book, and how just about the entirety of this, while with drastically different lengths, it's almost an entire reversal. I think a lot of the language is saying things like, the law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth because the wicked are surrounding, and things such as that, and this is the exact opposite. God's basically, in this description, showing up, and just because of how glorious He is, the entire earth is shattering. And that's, it's just such a powerful opposite of your law is paralyzed and not doing anything. Justice is sitting forth, the unrighteous have overpowered, and things like this. And this is just in this short amount of reading, so drastically.
Yeah, that's a good point. Tracing Habakkuk's line of thinking from the beginning of the book to the end, even in such a short book, how far he has moved from thinking that nothing good is happening to realizing just how magnificent God is and God's judgment and God's presence and all of that. Thanks. Greg?
I noticed the same thing, but in the use of another word that's silent. He begins by asking God, why are you silent? But then he says he's going to just climb up in his tower and wait. And then he says, in 2:20, the Lord is in His temple, let all the earth be silent before Him. And then he says in 3:16, I will wait quietly on the day of the Lord. But then he ends it and says, I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in the God of my salvation. So he again also changes the story. He starts out railing against God, and then he just says, okay, God, we're at Your mercy.
Yeah. What else? No? Yeah.
Side question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I noticed a lot of, there's a lot of references to rivers and seas and even some specific locations that I don't necessarily know where they were. There's like Mount Paran and Kushan, was that kind of the Babylonian area? Is that related to the Kushites?
That's part of what we're not sure about. So a couple things here. Teman is Edom. Mount Paran is in that general vicinity as well. And given some of the references to plague and pestilence and all of that, Midian as well, the indignation against the sea and so forth. You rode on, I don't know where to go. I lost my spot, or what I'm looking for. So a lot of this language that kind of brings to mind the Exodus. Trample the sea with your horses, a surging mighty water. A lot of this Exodus language, boy, that sentence was going somewhere when I started it. this is what I'm trying to say. At the beginning of this, it sounds like God is coming up from Sinai to his people to deliver them. Which is an interesting thing that God would be seen as coming from that vicinity rather than being in his temple. But whatever the case is, that seems to be the idea. What God has done in the past, he'll do something like it again. So that's what some of those references probably are about, is depicting God's arrival as being from that vicinity, coming up in that direction. So as to Kushan, there in verse 7... There are the Cushites. This is a little bit of a different word, if I remember correctly. But there is a king in the Judges who, it's a very long, obnoxious name, but the beginning of it is Cush. And so some have suggested maybe this is an abbreviation of that name because he was a king of Midian. But, yeah, that's the one. This might be a reference to God's victories in the past over the Midianites, but not exactly sure what's going on with that. For sure. At least I'm not exactly sure. Some people might be. So, does that help at all?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So would the whole wrath against the streams and the sea be more reminiscent of the Exodus than like a
Yeah, so that's what I was going to say that, and I forgot that was part of Andrew's question. The language of God's wrath against the sea and the rivers. There's a couple things that happen in the Bible. One is, of course, the parting of the Red Sea and the Exodus and all of that. And the other is language in the Old Testament, where the Old Testament writers are borrowing the language of pagan mythologies and saying, in effect, you think this is true of your gods, but let me tell you the real truth about the real God. And it's not acknowledging that those mythologies are true in any sense. It's just using that language to talk about how great God is. And we don't have time to unpack all of that right now. But this is something that is present throughout the Old Testament in a variety of places here and there. God goes to war with the sea. And in the pagan mythologies, the gods go to war with the sea gods, really. One of the sea gods is named Sea. So you can see how that could be a little confusing. Is he going to war with Sea, the god, or is he going to war with the sea, the body of water? And context tells you one way or the other. Now, what's significant about that is in several places that language shows up in the Old Testament, the language of God going to war with the sea or God going to war with Rahav, which is another one of the names of these sea monsters, it is used to describe the Exodus itself. And so whether this is, that mythological language or it's the Exodus, it's more of a blurred line than you might think, because a lot of times that language is used to describe the Exodus. So, All right, well, let's step aside from those things and talk about what this prayer shows us about prayer itself, how maybe we can grow in our praying from Habakkuk 3 and his prayer. What do you think? Yeah, Joy.
Putting trust in God, even when you don't know or like what's coming.
Yeah, trust in God even when you don't know what's coming, or you do know and you wish you didn't almost at that point. Trust in God come what may. There's a variety of ways to think about that. We'll leave it at that for now. We'll probably kind of come back around to that idea a few times. Martha?
Knowing that God has always been in control, and He always will be in control.
Okay. And God being in control isn't the same thing as me liking what God's going to do. Joy? Yeah, a recognition of who God is. That really shapes your life. It certainly shapes your praying. To recognize, to acknowledge, to be aware of who God is. And there's one of two things that happen when you come to understand who God is. You either accept it or you rebel against it. And the latter is the utmost foolishness, because you have no hope of overcoming Him in any way. A recognition of who God is, and with that an acceptance of who God is, and a trust in who God is and what He is going to do, with that an acceptance of what His plan is, whatever that might be. Martha? And of course, that's what we've been called to be. That's what we should be striving for. And it's pretty hard to become like Him if you don't know who He is. Yeah, it's a good thought. David?
Yeah, I love that hymn, Our Faith and Care, that has, Ready Thy Throne for Coming Prayers. The anticipation that there will be trials ahead, and that's what this passage has. But I love that it also goes one further, that in anticipation of those trials, he's also thinking for the blessings that are going to be coming after those trials that aren't even here yet. It's so forward thinking that it's two steps ahead. Just knowing the Lord and His character will take care of us in good times and bad, and that after that time will come.
Yeah. And you wonder, we don't get the rest of the story of Habakkuk. You wonder how he fared through the siege of Jerusalem, or if this is early enough that maybe he doesn't live to see it. It seems to be that this is pretty close to when that's going to happen, but who knows? Does he actually get to see any of the positive after effect? Is he young enough to live through the captivity and see the restoration? A lot of those things we don't know, but that doesn't seem to impact him at all. That, maybe I'll never see any of, what's going to happen to the Babylonians in response. I'll wait quietly for the day of trouble to come upon them, whether or not I ever see it. whether or not I'm with the people who get set free and get to come home or whatever else. That's not what is driving his thought process. It's just his trust in God in general. Andrew?
Yeah, I similar to comments made earlier, I wanted to note just the growth of his prayers through the book as well. I mean, I think in a few different ways. A, they're getting much longer as it goes, and as well, growing understanding of who God is and what that includes, more so than just not being able to stand evil, but what he's going to do about that, and then coping with it when it's not what he thought it was going to be and not what he wanted it to be. And also the level of preparation and such that went into each of these prayers. It seems so obvious. I mean, this is a more well thought out prayer than I think I've ever said in my life. The amount of thought and such that had to go into this prayer that we're reading right now is incredible in comparison to what we're used to.
We tend to think of praying as something that's, you know, impromptu and extemporaneous, and I don't know that it always should be. There's certainly times for that. We'll run into that in Nehemiah once we get to that point. But you know, beyond that, the thought that, you know, you should never, you know, write down prayers. I've run across that once or twice, and it's just so weird to me that people think there's something inferior about giving, you know, thought to praying, as if that's a bad thing. And yeah, you could imagine Habakkuk, he may have prayed something like this, you know, all on its own and in a very extemporaneous form the very first time he prayed it, and yet he keeps coming back to the same prayer and keeps coming back to it, and as he says it and re-says it and re-says it, it eventually takes this form. Or maybe he sat down and started working on it, you know, from the very beginning, planning on writing it out like this. But whatever the case may be, yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of thought that has gone into this and the construction of this prayer. Yeah, Dan?
So I could be way off on this, but in verse 4, it says the hiding of the tower, but the rest of the chapter is all about the tower, where the creation trembles. Mm-hmm.
Whether that's exactly what this means or not, I think you're right. That's absolutely the case. Is God is not showing us everything about himself and his power. That has been veiled. That has been kept back. And there will come a day where it will be unambiguously clear who God is and what it means that he's God. And you know, you get glimpses of it from time to time in the text of the Bible, and people in history have gotten glimpses of it from time to time as well. And the Israelites standing around Mount Sinai got glimpses of his power in a very real sense. But aside from that, it is trusting in God, and that's you have to believe that that's who he is and what he's going to do. Yeah, Noah? Good thought. Thanks. Stephen, you were going to say something?
Related to that, 13 perhaps is the most graphic of all, that last line. This is destruction. This is not, you know,
yeah, and I think the more you recognize who God is, the more frightening the prospect of all of it is, because you realize just what that means. The more you realize it's needed sometimes, but at the same time, my body trembles, my lips quiver, rottenness enters into my bones, my legs tremble beneath me. There is real fear here, yet I will rejoice in the Lord, and I'll take joy in the Lord and the God of my salvation. And the fear and the joy there are coupled here is its own paradox, I suppose, in some senses. And maybe that's we understand that to some degree a little bit more, going all the way back up to verse 2 again, and what I said is maybe something of a summation of this entire prayer: in wrath, remember mercy. There is, and not that this is what you were saying, but there is no call for wrath for the sake of wrath. It is wrath for the judgment of God, for the righting of wrongs. And with the call for wrath is a call for mercy as well. Martha?
And a call for correction from God. How are we going to know if we're not doing it right and not correct it? So it just ends with that.
Troy? Joey, were you going to say something a second ago? Where? Yeah, Debbie. All right, well, we are out of time, so we'll stop there and move on to Jeremiah 32 next week.